Going through the Gospel of John, we started in chapter 1, verse 1, and we're working verse by verse, chapter by chapter through the entire book. Today we're looking at John chapter 11, and this is the second half of the story of Lazarus. If you were with us last week, we looked at the introduction of this story. Jesus had run away from Jerusalem because people were trying to kill him, right? Officials and soldiers hunting Jesus down, and so he left, right? He escaped at great peril to his life, and he was all the way on the other side of the Jordan River, almost outside of the boundaries of Israel, when he received an urgent message that his dear friend, Lazarus, the one that you love, Jesus, his sisters wrote, is dying. And we saw last week that Jesus, instead of going immediately to heal his friend, which he had the power to do, Jesus instead stayed on the other side of the Jordan 2 extra days. And it wasn't until he knew that Lazarus was dead that he left for Bethany, right, to visit Lazarus, to visit Mary and Martha. And so this is where we pick up today. Jesus has waited, Lazarus has died, and Jesus has now arrived on the scene at Bethany. And he's walked in on a funeral, because funerals in the ancient world lasted for a week, right? It wasn't just a one-day affair. They were long, long drawn-out seasons of mourning. And so he's walked in on the funeral. And this is where we pick up. This is the last of Jesus' signs and wonders that we see in the Gospel of John. And as we read this, we draw near to the end of the first half of John, which has been called the Book of Signs. So let's go to John chapter 10, verse 17, all the way through verse 44. This is the reading of God's Word. Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord. I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world." When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?" Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." May God add his blessings to the reading of his word. 2 years ago, there was an amazing story that came out of Chile. Many of you may remember it. It's a story of 33 miners who were trapped when a gold and copper mine collapsed, right? These 33 men were trapped over 2,000 feet down deep in the earth, and everyone had assumed when this collapse happened that they were lost. There was no possible way that anyone could have survived something like this. Nevertheless, the Chilean authorities, the government sponsored a search and rescue mission, and so they drilled holes into the mine to search for signs of life. 17 days after the accident, 17 days of finding nothing, no sign of survival, no sign of life, on the 17th day, they pulled up one of the drills, and on the drill there was a note taped to it, and in bold red letters, there was a note written, "We are all well in the shelter, the 33 of us." And if you know the story, you know that these 33 men, these miners, were all recovered. They were all rescued. They spent a total of 69 days in the mine. After discovering that note, it took that long to unearth them, to create a way for them to come up safely. But in the end, every single one of them made it out alive. And this was televised. Some of you may remember watching on television as these Chilean miners were brought out of the earth, right? And the cheer and jubilation and the wonder of that moment, the inspiration of the moment. People have called the story of these 33 Chilean miners a miracle. And in a lot of ways, that's exactly what it was. Because people are not supposed to survive 2,300 feet underground after a cave-in. This is not supposed to happen. Watching these men emerge from the mine was like watching people come back to life. It was like people being brought out of a tomb. It was a resurrection story. And so whether you're here believing in Jesus or figuring out what it means to believe in Jesus, all of us love a good resurrection story, don't we? What is it that's attractive and inspiring about stories like this? Resurrection stories, stories of defying death, right? Defying the odds. These stories inspire us because every single one of us want to believe that it's possible to come back from death. We want that. We want to believe that that even in hopeless situations, there is always a reason to still have hope, to still believe. Resurrection stories are inspirational. And today's story is a resurrection story. It's a story of the resurrection of a man named Lazarus. Lazarus was dead. He was buried in a tomb. He was in a place where no one could help him. His sisters, Mary and Martha, could not help him. His friends could not help him. His government could not help him. No one could help Lazarus. No one, that is, except Jesus. So today we're going to look at this miracle. And if you've been studying John with us these past several months, every time we've looked at a miracle, we've looked at three things: the problem, the miracle, and the promise. Every miracle has this: a problem, the miracle, and a promise. And that's what Jesus shows us in the resurrection of Lazarus. We're going to look at the problem with death, the miracle of resurrection, and the promise of the resurrection. This is, in the end, a promise for every single one of us here. An inspiring story, but more than just an inspiring story, a promise that you too can have hope when things feel hopeless, that you too can have life after death, that you too can have a life that is not defined by the bad things and hurt that happens to you, but a life that is defined by the presence and power and love of your Creator and of your Redeemer. So we're going to look at these three things: the problem, the miracle, and the promise. So let's look first at the problem. Well, the problem seems obvious enough, doesn't it? What's the problem that we're presented with in this story? The problem is death. Lazarus has died. But what John does for us, the Apostle John, in this biography, is he shows us that death is a bigger problem than we think it is. You see, the problem with death is that it is not a natural part of life. Death is not part of some cycle of life and birth and rebirth. It's not a path to nothingness or non-existence. Death is devastating, and death is way worse than we think it is. And this is accentuated for us by Jesus' delay. We're confronted with it from the very beginning of this passage. Jesus arrives too late. He didn't come in time to save Lazarus from dying. By the time Jesus arrived, Lazarus had already been dead for 4 days. He was buried, and people were gathered for the funeral. Listen to Mary and Martha. Martha comes up to Jesus, and what's the first thing that she says to him? She says, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Mary says the same thing. She says, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Throughout the funeral, people were surprised and they were disappointed by Jesus' late arrival. They said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?" This is what death does. Death accentuates God's absence. Lazarus's death made Jesus' absence more real, more significant, and more painful. It challenged the belief that God cares, right? Isn't that what death does? Death really makes us ask questions about God. I'm sure the people affected by that tragedy at SFO yesterday were asking questions about God. Why does God let planes crash? Why does God let tornadoes tear through cities? Like that massive tornado that we saw in Moore, Oklahoma, just months ago. Why does God let terminal illness take the lives of people that we love? Death makes us ask questions of God. When we see death, when we're confronted with death, we can't help asking where God is and what God is doing. And what John wants to do here, as we look at the death of Lazarus, is he wants to show us that death, we think that death is a problem, but it's even more of a problem than we think it is. Death is a visible sign that not all is well between God and his creation. The fact that death exists shows us that we're separated from God, that there's something wrong between God and us, a world filled with sickness, disease, with violence, with death, with tragedy, is not a world that is at peace with God. These are signs that we are at war with our Creator. There's nothing peaceful about death in this passage. Nothing peaceful about it. Here, the picture of death that we get is a picture that of a vicious enemy. Death is the worst enemy any human being will ever have. And this is heavy, right? John wants us to understand the full weight of the heaviness of death. But the bad news about death is actually the beginning of good news. Because you can't fix something if it's not broken. You can't fix something if it's not broken. Our children have these toys in our homes that friends who hate us buy for our children. Right? There are toys that make a lot of noise. And the worst of these toys are the ones that don't have off buttons. Right? I don't know why manufacturers create toys without off buttons other than to torment parents. But we have these toys that will make noise, and they're like motion sensitive. So you walk by them in a dark room, and all of a sudden they'll start making noise. They'll start singing a song or talking to you, or anything. It freaks you out, right? These toys are horrible. And the worst part of it, right, is that there's no off button. It was designed that way. That's what's horrible about these toys. They were designed to torment and annoy parents, right? They're not broken. They're just poorly conceived. They're poorly designed. Right? You can't fix something that's not broken. And that's the good news about death. The good news about death is that life is not supposed to be this way. Human beings were not created to die. Death is not a design flaw. It's a problem that needs to be fixed. And this is what God wants to show us in this passage. The bad news about death is really the beginning of good news, because it shows us that life is not meant to be lived this way. The Christian faith, of all things, validates your pain. And you are supposed to be sad when people die. Even if you are a Christian that believes that the person who died is saved by Jesus, right? Even when a Christian dies and you know that this person is in heaven, even then you are supposed to be sad. Death is supposed to be a sad event. Death is not the way life was supposed to be. And so the Christian faith validates pain, it validates sorrow, it validates loss, it validates fear. And through the Bible, God tells us we are not meant to live this way. And even if you don't believe in God, you know, don't you? You know deep in your bones that there's something desperately wrong about death. You know that death is not natural. You know that we are not supposed to have that kind of sadness in our life. Our lives are broken, and they need to be fixed. That's the problem. What's the miracle? How does Jesus fix the problem? Let's look at the miracle. Well, Jesus let Lazarus die, but it wasn't because he didn't care. It wasn't a design flaw, but he let him die in order to fix him, to bring him back to life. He let Lazarus die in order to show us that he could fix the problem of death. He reached into death itself and pulled Lazarus out. And in this instant, as we see Jesus bringing Lazarus out of the grave, Jesus reverses all the sorrow, all the pain, and the loss of that funeral, and he turns it into a place of awe and wonder and unexpected joy. When Jesus first arrived at the funeral, what did he say? He told Martha, "Your brother will rise again." And Martha didn't really understand what Jesus is saying. She said, "I know, Lord. I know that he'll rise again on the last day." She believed that God would fix death eventually, but she didn't know that he was going to do it right there and then. She did not expect God to fix death that day because she didn't really fully understand who Jesus was. And how does he answer Martha? When Martha says, "I know, Lord. I know God's going to bring him back from the dead on the last day." Jesus says, "I am the resurrection and the life. I am the resurrection of the life." This is one of the seven I am statements that we see in the Gospel of John. Seven times John uses this phrase, "I am." Literally in the New Testament Greek, it would read, I am, right? I am the resurrection of the life. But that would just sound weird in English, right? Which is why it's not translated that way. But what John is actually doing is he's going back to Exodus when God reveals his name to Moses as the I am, right? And he's saying, "I, God, the I am the resurrection and the life." And so Jesus here is telling us, "I am the God. God has come down and God has become the resurrection of the life." What does that mean for God to become the resurrection of the life? Well, here Jesus gives us a picture of how God fixes death. How does God fixed death. He fixes death by becoming the resurrection. And that's a profound thing. You see, fixing death is not like fixing a broken car or a broken toy. Fixing death is like fixing a gambling debt. If you're a parent and one of your children comes to you with a gambling debt, they owe $500,000, right? They just somehow went in that deep, right? And some thugs are going to come and break their legs, maybe kill them, and they come to you for help. Can you do something? Mom, Dad, I'm in trouble. I have this gambling debt. I'm in $500,000. Can you help me? Well, as a parent, how do you fix a gambling debt? The only way to fix your child's gambling debt is to become your child's gambling debt. Right? You need to do whatever you can. Maybe some of you have $500,000 just lying around, but a lot of us who don't, what would I have to do? Well, if I had to pay off a $500,000 gambling, I'd have to sell all my possessions, right? I'd have to take out loans. I would have to basically, you know, be enslaved to debt the rest of my life in order to somehow pay off this debt for my child. To fix a gambling debt, you need to become the gambling debt. And this is the reason Jesus is so emotionally moved at this funeral. This passage has the shortest verse in the Bible. Right? Anybody who's ever competed in a Bible trivia competition, you probably know this, right? The shortest verse in the entire Bible, Jesus wept. But think about it. Why is Jesus crying at the funeral? We understand why Mary and Martha are crying. We understand why all the friends of Lazarus are crying. Why is Jesus crying? Jesus knows what's about to happen. He knows that he's about to bring Lazarus back to life. He should be smiling. He should have a smirk on his face. Why is Jesus crying? Why is he weeping? Well, John even goes further than that. He actually says that he's moved and troubled. He says it two times, that he's deeply moved and troubled. And this is another case of the New Testament Greek just being poorly translated. Because the literal meaning of those words, moved and troubled, literally in Greek means angry. But it's confusing. Why is Jesus crying? Why is he angry? Of all the emotions to feel at a funeral, why would Jesus be angry? Well, to understand why Jesus was angry, we really need to look further into the story of his life. If you're a Harry Potter fan, you may know that J.K. Rowling, before she wrote the first book, knew how the entire series would end. Right? And so the way that she wrote the story, the crafted the story in the first book and all the books in between, they were written with the knowledge of how the story would end. Right? She would know what would happen at the end with Harry, what would happen with Voldemort. And if you read the last book in the Harry Potter series and you go back to the first, or if you watch the last movies and you go back and watch the earlier ones, things start to make sense and you start to see things differently. And this is what John is doing here in this passage. When John wrote this passage, he knew how the story would end. He knew how the story would end. And so he left specific details in this passage that we are meant to remember later in the story. And listen to how John describes Lazarus's grave. He describes Lazarus's grave as a cave with a stone laying against it. Well, if you know the story of Jesus, does that sound familiar to you? This is a description of Jesus' tomb. This is a description of Jesus' grave. His grave looked just like Jesus' grave. And so as Jesus stood at the tomb of Lazarus, he stood confronted with his own death. Jesus was crying, he was weeping, he was angry, he was overwhelmed, because as he looked at Lazarus' death, he understood his own death. He understood that in order to fix death, Jesus had to become death. In order to fix sin, he had to become sin. In order to fix alienation with God, he had to become our alienation with God. And this is why Jesus is moved, why he's weeping, why he's angry. And here's the beautiful thing. If a father sells everything, if I sold everything that I had to pay off my kid's gambling debt, how messed up would my relationship with him be? Right? It would be hard for me to look at him without being a little bit disgusted and disappointed. Right? I mean, our relationship would be not good for a long time. It would take a powerful work of God to reconcile that. But the beautiful thing here is that Jesus is staring at the grave and he's angry. He's overwhelmed with emotion. He's overwhelmed with anger. But he's not angry at Lazarus. He's angry with death. That's the beautiful thing about this picture. The beautiful thing about the gospel. In fact, you can almost summarize the gospel in this way. That the gospel is this. The good news, the central message of the Bible, is that God hates your sin and yet loves you. He loves you. He hates death and yet loves you. He hates your brokenness. He hates your pain. And yet, he loves you. Here, Jesus is furious with death. And yet, he is not furious with Lazarus. This is the beautiful thing about the resurrection. Jesus, the miracle of resurrection, the solution for death, that the wonderful, incomprehensible thing about the way that God saves us is that he saves us by becoming our sin, by becoming our death, by becoming our pain, by becoming our sorrow, by becoming our brokenness, by becoming even our unbelief. And he uses it to create resurrection and life from the tomb. This brings us to the last point. Every miracle has a problem. It has a solution, the miracle itself, and then it has a promise. And this miracle is more than just an isolated miracle. It's a promise. Sinclair Ferguson, one of my favorite theologians, once said that when Jesus brought Lazarus back from the dead, he called him out by name. Did you notice that in there? He says, "Lazarus, come out." And Ferguson says, he called out Lazarus by name because if he didn't, all the dead people buried all over the earth would have come out. Right? Like if Jesus said, "Come out from the grave," everybody would have come out. He had to call Lazarus by name. Right? Right. This is more than simply about Lazarus. This is a promise. The resurrection of Lazarus was a promise. And we get a picture of this in what by looking at what happens after Lazarus comes out of the grave. The resurrection itself is pretty shocking. Jesus told Mary and Martha to have the people take the stone away. And Martha's response is, "He's been dead 4 days. He's going to smell really bad." Right? And if you've ever been at a funeral, if you've ever had someone close to you die, one of the most painful moments in any funeral, the most painful moment when my dad died, without question, was the moment that we lay the casket into the tomb. That was the most painful. And then there was a ceremonial, you know, putting flowers and, you know, shoveling that first shovel of dirt over the casket. I mean, that's the most painful thing. Now, imagine in the middle of the funeral, the pastor coming in and saying, let's dig him up. Let's dig it up. And I mean, how painful, how inappropriate, how crazy is this? And Martha says, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days." And this is her polite way of saying, "Jesus, are you out of your mind? Don't you know what's going to happen when we open that tomb?" And he responds, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" And here Jesus shows us a wonderful picture of what resurrection is. Resurrection really is that promise that in the middle of everything in your life that just stinks like rotting flesh, in the horror of death, you can still see the glory of God. Jesus says, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me." And then he said, "Lazarus, come out." And out from that musty, dark grave, Lazarus came out. And just like Martha said, he smelled bad. He was still wearing his grave clothes. And so what does Jesus say? He tells the people, unbind him and let him go. The promise of resurrection is that there is life, right? Your entire life is defined by it. Lazarus had an entire life to live after his resurrection. Jesus shows us that life is not meant to be bound by death, but life is meant to be unbound by death. So I want to close with just three thoughts for us to take home today as we look at Lazarus' resurrection, as we look at how Jesus called him out from the grave, as he exposed everybody to the stink of death, and as he unbound Lazarus from his clothes. What can we take away? Well, number one, it's okay to admit that death and sometimes life stinks. It's okay to admit that. Sometimes it's easy as a Christian when we're faced with tragedy to sugarcoat it. Oh, there must be a reason for this. Oh, I know that, you know, that God has a purpose for this. Well, that's true. But it's okay as a Christian to say it stinks. And that's one of the most beautiful things about the Psalms. When you read the Psalms, you know, the Old Testament saints who wrote the worship songs and worship prayers of the Old Testament church, they knew what it was to bring your pain to God. They knew that it was a safe place, that God provided a safe place to be real about your pain. Jesus does not sugarcoat death. He does not sugarcoat pain. And it's okay to admit that it smells really bad, that life stinks, that death stinks. Number two, it's okay to ask God what he's doing when life stinks. It's okay to ask him. Right? What did Mary and Martha say? They said, Lord, if you had been here, our brother would still be alive. I mean, that's the kind of question that close friends ask of each other, right? They had an intimacy and relationship with Jesus that made it safe for them to ask him what he was doing. Ed Welch, who is a counselor, he's a Christian counselor, he's also a professor of Christian counseling, and also he's a pastor, Ed Welch. He recently wrote about these life moments when it seems like God is nowhere to be found. When you lose a child, for example, or when you're shamefully victimized, or when you go through what feels like death itself, when you can't help asking the question, where is God, where was God, what is God doing? And this is what Welch writes. He says, in these moments, he says, ask him. The most obvious answer is to ask God himself. The question to him is a fair one, but you might notice incipient unbelief in that you don't believe that God hears you or is accessible. Unbelief prefers to talk about God rather than to him. Rule number one is to talk to the Lord, especially during hardships. Right? You have permission to ask God what he's doing. That's a fair question, and it's a question that God can handle. Don't just spend your time talking about God, talk to him. And especially when life is dark, when God seems far away, these are the times that we especially need to ask him, Lord, what are you doing? Last takeaway, it's okay to take your grave clothes off. And this is the beautiful thing about how Lazarus' story ends. Lazarus didn't wear the grave clothes. He took them off. And the rest of his life that he lived would be defined not by his death or by the fear of death. I mean, can you imagine what it would have been like to be Lazarus, to know the power of God to bring us back from death to life? I mean, his life had to be different from anyone else's. He must have had a freedom, right? A freedom in his life. He knew that those grave clothes, even if he were to wear them again, would never stick. And this is what God wants to give us. You see, the promise of the resurrection is that you don't need to die in order to experience the power of the resurrection. you could experience the power of the resurrection now. You don't have to wait to go to heaven to experience heaven. You could experience heaven in your life now because you, just like Lazarus, now if you are in Jesus, you have a life where death has lost all its power, where death has lost its sting, where death has no claim over you. This is the life that God wants to give you. He swallowed up your sin. He swallowed up your pain. He swallowed up your death. And even though sad things happen to you in this life, and even though hard things happen to you in this life, even though painful things happen to you in this life, these things cannot define you, and they cannot stick to you, because what does define you is the reality that you're loved by God. So loved that he died for you and he rose again for you and he wants to live forever with you. This is what defines you. You're able to live your life unbound from death. The story of resurrection, it's really not about Lazarus. It's about you. And so come to him, put your trust in him, admit to him how painful and hard life is sometimes. Ask hard questions of God, and don't let the pain in your life define you. Let's pray.